Coming this evening. It's really nice to see everybody. As Tom says, my name is Chris Fishlock. Over the years, I've had a number of embarrassing encounters, as you can imagine, with a name like that. I received a letter not so long ago to a Mr. Dishcloth, and I've never known if they were doing that on purpose or not. Anyway, it's really nice to be able to welcome you here this evening. I hope you'll be able to get hold of one of these booklets. I'll be referring to that as we go. I won't be quoting all of the quotes in there. There'll be good reference. There's a little bibliography at the end as well if you'd like to sort of follow things through. Let me just start with a story. It's about 20 years ago. A person who's now a friend of mine, I didn't know him at the time, he was studying at LSE. I think we've got a few people from LSE here this evening. So I thought you'd be interested to know that there was a chap there 20 years ago or so who had been brought up in a Buddhist and Hindu family in Singapore. His education was therefore, in his own words, secular, religious, confused, and materialistic. He had a lot of things going on in his head. As he studied over here at LSE, somebody invited him along to a Christian talk. It wasn't a talk on this subject. I don't know what the subject was on. It doesn't really matter, but halfway through the talk, he decided that he was bored out of his mind, that the person speaking was not interesting him at all. And so he picked up a Bible, and he flicked to the back of this Bible, and in the back, he found some maps, and he suddenly realized that the Christian faith springs from real historical events with real people that moved around the world and recorded historical events. Now, that was very different to everything that he'd observed in terms of the sort of myth and legend of his religious background and the theory of his materialistic background. And in a sense, tonight, we have an opportunity to consider an alternative to all of that sort of jumble and confusion. And so I hope you'll find our question this evening, something that you really do want an answer to. Can I trust the Bible? That's the question, the proposition. You'll find the top of page 2. We'll go through some details now. We'll move relatively quickly through the material. At any point, I mean, Tom's already alerted us to this, but at any point, do just jot down a question. Rather than putting up your hand at the time, jot down a question, and then Tom will ask those questions on your behalf at the end. Absolutely fine. You can be as rude and direct as you like. You are welcome to do that, as long as you write it down. So I hope that makes sense. Let me just start this evening, as we consider this question, by explaining briefly that I think this question not only matters, but it may be more important than you realized. What do I mean by that? Well, let me just give you an executive summary. We're talking about the Bible, okay? That is the subject. Can I trust the Bible? Tom's already said there's a stack of them there at the back. You're welcome to take one away if you're a guest, gift from us. Please, can I trust it? Why is that important? Let me give you an executive summary of the Bible. This is what's at stake. The Bible's all about Jesus Christ. It's an amazingly accessible account of a person, too compelling not to take seriously. I guess the simple fact that you're here this evening suggests that you're willing to at least consider that proposition. Thank you again for coming. Three areas that the Bible breaks into. The Old Testament, Jesus was promised. This bit of the Bible goes right back long, long time before Jesus actually came. It gives a very clear, increasingly clear picture of what Jesus will one day be like when he comes. And importantly, why it is essential that Jesus comes. We come to the Gospels, the first four books of the New Testament. You probably heard them, you might have even read them, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They give an account of Jesus' life, his death, his resurrection. It's like having four different newspapers which report on what Jesus said and did, and importantly, what people at the time thought about Jesus. The rest of the New Testament then explains how Jesus establishes the church. He then returns to heaven. Before he returns to heaven, he leaves a promise to one day return and hold humanity to account. Jesus says, and this is where we get under the skin, Jesus says every human being will one day stand before him and be judged by his standard, not what we think he might want. So this is why it really matters. We live in a world where this book actually claims that a man died and did not stay dead. This book claims that Jesus rose from the dead. The resurrection, if true, proves that death is not the end. That changes everything. That's the world in which we live. What's at stake? Well, what's at stake is we can take Jesus' words seriously. He says it's possible to have a relationship with God. That changes everything again. We can have not just a relationship with God, but we can find meaning and purpose in this life. I'm no longer just chasing stuff. That guy I was telling you about from, his name's Dinesh. He's a good friend of mine now. He leads a church in Singapore where he came over from, the guy who studied at LSE. I mean, he just, you know, with his very sort of secular education, just said, you know, life, as far as he was concerned when he was at LSE, it was about chasing stuff. No longer. Purpose and meaning. Secondly, certainty in the face of death and safety beyond the grave. So the proposition absolutely matters. I put it there on your first page there. The Bible is not a collection of made-up stories. It is reliable history. It can be trusted. So let's go to the top of page 3. You'll see authorship there. Dual authorship, divine and human. Divine authorship. Christians believe the Bible was ultimately written by God. It is therefore, in every sense, inspired by him. And it's really important that we grasp what that means and what it doesn't mean. I mean, if the Bible was written by God, then it must be the highest source of authority. The only way you'll ever be convinced of the words that I've just said are if you read them yourself. Okay, you can't go to any other source of authority to prove an ultimate truth claim, which is what divine authority is. It is self-authenticating, that probably an idea you're familiar with. I mean, I too was once, like some of you here tonight, a skeptic. I'm now in a position of being able to say, I have read the Bible and I know it is God's divine word. It was indeed inspired by him, carefully written down. When I heard a talk like this, it didn't convince me that it was God's word. It helped to sort of push me over the line to think, yeah, I can take this seriously. It's credible. It meshes with history. It fits. I'm going to give it a try. Give it a try. You come to your own conclusion. Don't take my word for it. That's what divine authority and self-authentication means. Do ask questions on that if you like. Let's move on. Human authorship. You see, the way God chose to give us divine words was not by sort of magic writing on the wall. It was through human authors. And let me tell you a few fun facts about the Bible. It is the best-selling book of all time. It's never included in publishers' best-selling list because it just looks so boring to always have the Bible at the top, but it is at the top, so they always go to the next one. That's in the Guinness Book of Records. It's actually not one book. It's 66 books, different types of writing, historical narrative, poetry, prose, letters, all sorts of different types of writing, 40 different authors. For example, Joshua, he was a military general. Daniel was a prime minister. Peter was a fisherman. Paul was a lawyer. Don't let that put you off. He wrote a lot of the New Testament. Very, very good stuff. Interestingly, the whole of the Bible was written over a period of time, about 1,500 years. That's a long period of time. It was written in three different languages, Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic. And it was written on three different continents. And yet, amazingly, despite all of that, it tells a very joined up story, a common storyline, we might say, creation, fall, redemption of God's people, a common message. Humanity has a serious problem before the God that has made it. And God alone provides the solution. He sends, you won't be surprised to hear, Jesus. It's all about Jesus, just in case you missed that point. And the Bible gives a personal challenge. Will we trust him? Will we get ready? Be ready to meet Jesus. If you've ever heard a Christian say to you, oh, come to church, come, you know, I'd love you to meet Jesus. Well, the reality is you will meet Jesus. And the challenge of this evening is, do you want to be ready? So what about other religions? Well, top of page 4 now. It's a quote from an ancient historian, John Dixon. He writes, unlike the Hindu Upanishads, which focus on the believer's merger with the life force Brahman, or the Buddhist Tripitaka, which emphasizes the extinguishment of self and suffering, or the Islamic Quran, which centers on the nature and practice of submission to God. The New Testament revolves around a series of events said to have occurred in Palestine between 5 BC and 30 AD. Because Christianity is about Jesus, what he said, where he went, what he did, it's open to a level of questioning and scrutiny and examination that other religions are not. And Christians welcome that. It's a wonderful thing to be able to say, yeah, ask your questions. I meant what I said earlier. Ask the hardest questions that you can think of. I don't promise to have an answer, but I do know that the Bible can answer in the end and give coherent answers to everything. John Dixon again says, this quote isn't on your handout. It's as if the Christian faith places its head on the chopping block of public scrutiny and invites us all to take a swing. Well, that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a bit of a swing today. And we're going to focus the rest of our time just on the New Testament, thinking about the authenticity and trustworthiness of the New Testament. Why? Well, partly because of time. We don't have unlimited time. And secondly, interestingly, there's a degree of which if we can establish the authenticity, the reliability of the New Testament, well, that will also give credibility to the Old Testament because the New Testament is full of quotes of the Old Testament. And so one, in a sense, casts reassuring light on the other. There are two questions that need to be answered. You'll see middle of page 4 now. First, is the Bible reliable history? Second, has that history been accurately preserved? If we can say yes with some certainty to both, then I hope you'll agree at the very least it's worth the challenge of this evening. Let's give Jesus a second hearing. Let's read the Bible for ourselves. So first, is the Bible reliable history? Some would say no. Let's bring out the big guns. Well, I don't know how big a gun he is anymore, but here's Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, massively popular book, not as popular as the Bible, but it was right up there on the best-selling list for some time, as you probably remember. He's still considered the sort of the celebrity and evangelical atheist of our day. And you'll see some words that he quotes there. He obviously says, no, it's not reliable. Look at the underlined words there. Ever since the 19th century, scholarly theologians have made an overwhelming case that the Gospels are not reliable accounts of what happened in the history of the real world. Next paragraph. Much of what they wrote was in no sense an honest attempt at history. Now, top of page 5. Reputable biblical scholars do not in general regard the New Testament as a reliable record of what actually happened in history. Now, of course, when Professor Richard Dawkins writes reputable biblical scholars, what he actually means is people who agree with him, of course. There are many biblical scholars who don't agree with Dawkins. I could list them. I could quote them. But we can do better. Let's consider, near the top of page 5 still, what the New Testament says about itself. Much more important than what a scholar might say. You see, the New Testament says that it is an eyewitness account. That's the testimony that it gives about itself. Listen to a letter that John wrote. Now, John is a good friend. I say is because I believe it's a present tense reality. He's not dead, but let's, he's with Jesus now. But of course, he did live 2,000 years ago with Jesus, and he was a close friend of Jesus. He was the author of John's Gospel, and he wrote this in one of his letters. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, have touched with our hands concerning the word of life, the life that was made manifest. And we have seen it, testified to it. We proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and was made manifest to us. That which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you too may have fellowship with us. And indeed our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. Often in the Bible, there is repetition of ideas that the author wants us to get our head around. And you can see the repetition. It's multi-sensory here. That which we have heard, which we have seen, which we have looked upon, which we have touched. the life was made manifest, seen it, testified to it, verse 2. Do you see what John is doing? Seeing, hearing, touching, talking about Jesus. And what he's saying is, this encounter that he had with Jesus brought him into fellowship with the Father, a reference to God. And then here's the really good bit, because he's writing to real people, and the letter down through the channel of time extends to us too. The really good bit for us is that we can share that experience of God by getting to know, well, we can't get to know Jesus, but we can get to know the author's testimony of Jesus. And he says that by fellowship with him, we can share their fellowship with the Father. That's what it says in verse 3. Have a look at it again. Little number 3 towards the end of that reading. That which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you too may have fellowship with us, and indeed our fellowship is with the Father. So do you see, in summary, an accurate account of the life of Jesus, carefully recorded, as we investigate that, we too can have fellowship with God. Again, don't take my word for it. Give it some thought yourself. Let's move on. Another possible objection. Here we got another one of the famous atheists, Christopher Hitchens. He's deceased now, but he, along with the others, he was one of the sort of I think they're known as the four riders of the apocalypse, the four horsemen of the apocalypse in terms of their celebrity atheism. This book, God is Not Great. By the way, it's a really interesting book. I wouldn't recommend it particularly. If you're going to read a book by an atheist, I'd definitely recommend The God Delusion, because you sort of think, if this is the best the atheist can do, it's pretty poor. So you give it a read and you decide. I don't think this is as good. Basically, the premise of this book is that religion, I think it might even say there in his introduction, religion poisons everything. But he's got a particular hatred for Christianity, and I put a quote there on the thing. He basically said, you know, God is not great. And the Gospels, as he attacks them, are hearsay upon hearsay upon hearsay. I'm sorry, but that sounds to me like somebody who has not ever read them. Not themselves. I don't know. They read some sort of one of Dawkins' scholarly theologians that doesn't agree with them. It's not hearsay. It's reliable testimony emerging from and verified by the eyewitness community. Let me explain what I mean by that. That it emerges from the eyewitness community is the point already made in John's letter. Do you remember? We've seen, we've heard, we've touched, we've had fellowship with Jesus. We know God because of getting to know him. So it was already emerging from the community. But interestingly, it's also verified by the community. You see, it's not that one man saw something. Oh, wow, guess what? I've just seen this incredible guy, Jesus. Gets on his camel, goes over a mountain, finds a community of people that have no understanding of that event, and then tells them about these amazing things he's seen that they haven't. Not at all. The accounts were written into a community of people that had integrated with Jesus. That's very important. Real people, real events, lots of features of geography and names and places. The New Testament is packed full of all sorts of details. It's almost like it's sort of saying to its readers at the time, oh yeah, go and check with this person who lives on this street about the events that I'm talking about, because they'll corroborate them. There's all sorts of tests that you can apply to this. I mean, it's incredible the scrutiny that people will apply to the Bible. Anyway, the test of geography, I put it there. It's listed much better than I'm about to explain it in this book, by Peter J. Williams. If you want one sort of very accessible book on the trustworthiness of the New Testament, this is really, really good. He makes the point very simply that the gospel writers refer to bodies of water and roads and means of travel and gardens and details of landscape. They even if you sort of were to take all of the access to potential material that might have existed that we have knowledge of back in the day that the gospel was written, it still isn't enough to explain that the observations that they accurately make. In fact, the gospels provide today, in terms of the source of geographic information, they provide valuable source material on geographic observations. No other places to go to. That doesn't prove anything, but it eliminates objections. Especially when people come along and say, oh, it's all just made up. Secondly, the test of names. I really like this. This is a much heavier book, heavyweight book, Richard Malcolm. This is the Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. I hold it up. I haven't read all this, but I've skimmed through it, and I've read in detail this bit that I'm about to explain, which is really good. The test of names. Again, it proves, or at least gives us evidence which stops us being able to sort of rule out the fact that the gospel writers were very close to the events being spoken about. Let me try and illustrate what I mean. If I was going to write a story and set it here in London in 2025, then I'd have to make up a whole lot of sort of characters' names. Now, imagine if I made up a whole lot of characters that were called Ethel, Deirdre, Joseph, Alfred, Ernest, okay? I happen to use those names because they're the names of my grandparents. Now, you could say, well, it's possible that those people existed. You know, I might have hit on some of your names. I don't know you all. And they're great names, if that's your name. But they're unusual today. They're not normal names in our sort of world today. And actually, they were quite common names back in the 20s, 30s, 40s. And again, similar tests can be applied to the New Testament, which can give us high levels of confidence that the writers knew their stuff. They were using names that were common at the time. So let me just draw all this together where we got to so far. If you want to believe that the New Testament is not reliable, then you would have to believe that the four gospel writers, all the thousands of eyewitnesses who read and observed them, and all of, this is important, all of Jesus' opponents who nevertheless accepted his miracles, for example, the Pharisees and the Gospels, they never denied it. They tried to use his miracles to sort of stitch him up on technicalities. It's ridiculous. But you'd have to believe that all of those peoples were in some sort of math conspiracy. They'd all agreed to sort of keep things hushed. Let's move on. Top of page 6 now. The rest of the New Testament came from those who had personal access to eyewitness evidence. Like Luke, he was actually a medical doctor. He starts his gospel account like this. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things that you have been taught. Luke is writing so that his friend Theophilus might have absolute certainty of these events. It's not a fictitious account. It's an orderly account. It has a clear purpose. I wonder if you realize that one of the purposes of the Bible being written was to give you certainty of the content of the Bible. That's what Luke says, to make you certain. Well, you may be writing a question even now and saying, well, I mean, people today in our world make millions writing historical fiction. Why not back then? Dan Brown, Da Vinci Code fame, if he can do it, then why not John and the others? Two things I'd like to say about that. Again, do ask about it later if you'd like. That genre of writing, the historical fiction, that didn't exist for another 1,600 years. That's the earliest example that we have in English literature. But secondly, more importantly, you'd have to ask what on earth they have to gain from it. I mean, Dan Brown, he made a fortune. Okay, Da Vinci Code and all of that. When I last checked, he was worth $160 million. He did well from historical fiction. How did the Bible writers do? Well, they were criticized, ostracized, and martyred. And anyway, it would seem impossible to be able to pull off all of this simply because of the number of non-Christians writing about Jesus at the same time. Just to be clear, non-Christian historians writing about Jesus at the same time. Now, if the New Testament writers were in a mass conspiracy with one another, then they did a pretty amazing job paying off all these non-Christian historians. And again, you can check them. I've listed some of them there on pages 6 and 7, Roman and Jewish historians. Do have a look in your own time. I won't go through them. Let's jump to the summary, halfway down page 7. If you were to put together all the non-Christian, just the non-Christian sources of Jesus, then the following New Testament facts can be confirmed. The name Jesus, the place and time of his public ministry, Palestine, during the reign of Pontius Pilate, AD 26 to 36. You'll see all those other things. Jump down to the last 2 points on the list. The report of Jesus' appearance to his followers after his death, the flourishing of a movement that worshipped Jesus after his death. In other words, what could you establish just from non-Christian historians? Quite a lot. Look at the conclusion. Professor Craig Blomberg, second paragraph, top of page 8 now. A careful analysis of the genres of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts suggests that their writers were not only able to provide trustworthy history, but that they were intending to do so. The limited external evidence from non-Christian writers, later Christian writers, and archaeology almost always confirms that where they can be tested, the evangelists did record accurate historical information. All the above evidence is adequate to place the burden of proof on the shoulders of anyone who would deny the trustworthiness of untestable data. And so it's probably just worth pausing at this stage and asking you a personal question, something to consider maybe on the back of our time today. What would be your personal reason for doubting the reliability of the New Testament? I mean, to doubt it, to say, oh, I don't know about any of that stuff, it cuts against the grain of evidence. Maybe you have documents or some type of evidence that I don't have access to. More importantly, that the people that I've been quoting don't have access to. Maybe there's some special sort of silver bullet out there that has been hidden. I'd like to suggest instead that perhaps until now you didn't realize quite what the Christian faith was built on. You see, the gospel writers undoubtedly wrote history. That's the first question. The second question, which we'll consider much, much more briefly, did they write accurate history? Has it been preserved for us? You'll see another quote from Richard Dawkins. I won't read it all, but he levels the lost in translation argument. We're at the top of page 9 now. He uses the term Chinese whispers, and essentially, the argument sounds plausible until you consider the counter-evidence. Third of the way down page 11, so sort of small b on the handouts there. How do other ancient historical writings compare? Well, there's lots of sort of facts to look at, but just look at the number of manuscripts that we're talking about, and these are the best sort of examples that we've got in history. The number of manuscripts is almost incredible. What stands out are the number of New Testament writings that exist. All of these sort of historical events at a not dissimilar time, with a handful of surviving manuscripts. Look how many the New Testament has, 24,000 in a variety of languages. And look right down at the bottom of page 9 there. The time interval between when the document was first written and the earliest copy that survives to this day. Just take one example, Caesar. It's an account of his Gallic Wars. Very similar time period to the events of the New Testament. They were written down somewhere between 100 and 44 BC. But the earliest surviving or extant copy that we have today, 900 AD is the date of that. That's nearly a 1,000-year gap between when the event happened and the document that still exists today, which we sort of draw the reference from, 1,000 years. And yet you won't find a historian in this world that denies the events of Caesar and the Gallic Wars. Just flick to the back, keep your finger there, but flick to the back and have a look at this little fragment here. It's something quite famous if you're into sort of fragments of original documents. It's called P52, not very sort of imaginatively named. It's from a papyrus. It's called the Rylands Papyrus. You can go and see it, I think. It's still in Manchester in one of the Rylands Library, I think it's called there. And this is a fragment of John's Gospel. There's a reference there to where it comes from John chapter 18. Just a little fragment, but it was found in Egypt. It dates accurately to 130 AD. That's amazing. That means John's gospel was circulating in Egypt within a very short period of time, 100 years of the events. That is a very, very small interval. You go to the British Library, I've taken my children there, fun day out for the kids, and see the Codex Sinaiticus. It's one of my favorite books. It was a compilation of all of the New Testament books. It was found in St. Catherine's Monastery in Sinai, and it dates to the middle of the 4th century. That's incredible. New Testament as we have it today, within a few hundred years of Jesus. Let me explain how the documented evidence works. The events took place, and they were written down in different languages, Greek and Latin and Aramaic and Syriac, Gorian, a number of different languages. They were written down. And then, of course, those original documents that were first written down, of course, we don't have them today. They're on scrolls. The scrolls disintegrate. The earliest we got is that little fragment, P52. But those were copied down, were written down, and then they were copied and copied and copied. And down through the ages, those copies then carried through different languages. So here's the way you test the reliability of the source material. You compare the documents written in different languages with each other hundreds of years later. Compare them and see if their story says the same thing. If they all say wildly different things, then you say, well, nobody had a clue what was going on. Everything's changed. Dawkins is right. Lost in translation. If they say the same thing, then you say, actually, these look reliable. That's how history works. Now, what do you find when you do that exercise? Well, you find that when it comes to the New Testament, there are differences, there are variances. But these are listed in the Bible as footnotes. If you have a slightly different Bible to the one that we're giving away tonight, Bibles like this, you'll find it's full of footnotes. And the footnotes tell you where those differences lie. Between 1 and 3% of the New Testament has textual variances. But they're minor details. They're words and phrasing and grammar. It's nothing particularly serious. No doctrine changes, no actual event changes, occasional phrasing, that sort of thing. None of them deny that Jesus died on the cross or that he rose from the dead, nor do any other Christian truths come into doubt. The lost in translation argument cannot therefore be used to deny that these things actually happened. Dawkins' argument goes nowhere. In conclusion, we must draw threads. Look at the second paragraph on page 11. This is Sir Frederick Kenyon. The conclusion of the second question that we're considering. The interval then between the dates of the original composition and the earliest extant, that just means surviving evidence, becomes so small as to be in fact negligible. And the last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established. And so where does that leave us? Well, as I said, I wasn't trying to prove anything to you this evening. I was trying to remove a few hurdles and show you that the Bible is credible, that it is trustworthy, that it's worth another hearing, and that it's all about Jesus. Let me commend to you Jesus. It's worth getting to know him. I think Tom's going to come and explain a little bit more about how you might like to take that forward.